It's time to think bigger.
Elias Pettersson scores!
And think bolder.
Matthew Tkachuk, what a goal!
This is Rintoul and Sermon.
Another chance, great save by Markstrom.
There is shot, rebound, great save by Timko.
On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
What's going on? Hope your Tuesday is off to a great start. We have connection issues on my end by the sounds of things. I'm not sure how the audio is. I'm hearing me just fine. I hope everybody out there is as well. I hope your Tuesday's off to a great start. Karen, we've got breaking news to kick off the show with today in the National Hockey League. It happened in the last 20 minutes or so. Finding out that apparently the Minnesota Wild are going big-time buyout. We speculated about one of these last week. It seemed unlikely to me simply because of the cap hit that's going to happen, not this year, but next year and the couple years after that with Zach Parise. Not just one, but two, the massive deals that were signed by Parise and Suter, the 13-year packs. I'm sorry, Minnesota wants no part of those moving forward, but they're going to take a cap hit with them moving forward, apparently.
Talk about a Woj bomb, Russo bomb this morning, Bill Guerin bomb this morning coming out of Minnesota. Yes, the Ryan Suter, Zach Parise era is officially coming to an end in Minnesota. As you mentioned, Scott, we had talked about possibly Parise being a really good buyout candidate for the Minnesota Wild, just because of the fact doesn't seem like he was on Dean Evason's high list last season. A couple of scratches, healthy scratches in the playoffs and in the regular season, but man, oh man, Ryan Suter and Zach Parise. I thought Duncan Keith and no cap retention from Chicago was going to be a big talking point today, Scott, but nope. Mike Russo with the big drop earlier today from Minnesota.
Well, and if you're wondering what that means, it means they get some cap space this coming year. And with the way Minnesota overachieved in most people's estimation a year ago, maybe they're looking to capitalize sooner and deal with whatever comes. Maybe it's Bill Guerin betting on an increase in the cap flexibility. Elliot Friedman is among those over the last 2 or 3 months that said some general managers are looking at this as a 5-year flat cap in the National Hockey League. Maybe Bill Guerin knows something somebody else doesn't. Maybe he thinks that there's going to be a much better increase in coming years than those pessimists out there. But to carry $12 million plus 2 seasons from now, between $14.5 and $15 million in season 3 and season 4, man, is that a lot of money tied up with players that will not be playing hockey for your team.
Just think about it. These are on the books for the next 8 seasons. 8 seasons these contracts are going to be on the books. Maybe Bill Guerin's just looking at this in the here and now. Like, clears $10 million in cap space for this upcoming season. We know that Kirill Kaprizov wants to get paid. There's been the threat of him, you know, going to the KHL and everything that goes around with that. But we know that he's going to ask for some significant money. They got to keep Kevin Fiala, of course, and Scott. Does this just come down to protection at this point as well with the Seattle expansion draft? Like, you look at it, both Ryan Suter and Zach Parise were going to have to be protected by the Minnesota Wild. You take those two off the books. Now you get to protect, you know, your young defenseman in Matt Dumba, who was going to have to be exposed to the Seattle expansion draft. So if you're Bill Guerin, you're looking at, one, I can't lose Matt Dumba for something. I don't want to give assets away to Seattle to say, okay, you stay away from him, take somebody else. We all know how important assets are. And we heard yesterday, too, I think it was Elliot Friedman saying, like, Ron Francis is not moving as fast as a lot of general managers would like to move ahead of the Seattle expansion draft in terms of doing some deals, helping some teams out. He's also holding a lot of feet to the fire. So maybe this is a general manager going, hey, I can't wait. I need to keep this guy. I need to sign some top free agents, RFAs. I'm going to bite the bullet and just eat these contracts for the next 8 years.
You know, we had this conversation last week about who are the five general managers, who are the five teams that are going to define this NHL offseason? And we did have a couple of our listeners. You and I didn't have this team on our list, but we had a couple of texters out there, and you can get in today, 960-960 or 650-650. A couple of our listeners said, watch out for Minnesota. And you and I both went, okay, well, what is Minnesota really going to do? The one thing you look at is how aggressive Bill Guerin was last offseason and the tinkering he did and how quickly it paid off. Perhaps they believe they can capitalize here in the next little bit. It'll be an interesting discussion moving forward. What else happens as a result of this? How big a player does Minnesota become on the free agent market? Can they sign short-term deals? Can they do a trade to up the ante a little bit and give them a little bit of, I don't know, upward progression in that division? But, man, big news out of Minnesota this morning. Not something that you or I were expecting to be talking about. Perhaps by the time we get to Mike McKenna at the bottom of this hour, he's had a little more time. And we can have a conversation with him on that front as well. It's not the way I thought we were going to lead the show today, but I'm glad we get a little NHL news off the top.
It's funny, Scott, because I'm thinking, okay, they finished third in that division last year, but they're going back to the Central Division. Maybe Bill Guerin looks at this and he's going, you know, like, we got the Blues. What are they going to be next year? Colorado's Colorado. Dallas, you have to expect, you know, they had the challenges of COVID. You've got the Winnipeg Jets. Who knows how good they're going to be? Nashville Predators, they're up in the air. Chicago Blackhawks, well, they just got rid of one of their franchise-defining players. They're in a rebuild. Maybe Bill Guerin looks at this and goes, look, this is a chance for us to do really well in the Central Division. You look at Colorado, and they're probably only the real sure shot in that division. Again, I said Blues and Stars and Jets, but there's still question marks coming off of last season. So it's, hey, I give kudos to Bill Guerin because this takes guts, man. Like, this takes guts. You got to sell your ownership on this as well. You know, the cap hit was more than the actual money that was going to be paid out, so maybe that's something that has to do with it. It just, it's, good on him for, you know, being aggressive and being ahead of the game.
We didn't see big movement over the weekend, but you guys were blessed with a trade hitting you in the middle of the show yesterday, so you got that breaking news, and I know that consumed a lot of the second half of the show. You had the news from the weekend, of course. I think something happened on Sunday, didn't it? How glad were you, Karen, that I was not a part of this show yesterday after what transpired at Wembley Stadium on Sunday?
Jamie and I decided not to mention your name on the show yesterday. You were a taboo subject, Scott, when talking about Italy and England. I did give you kudos. I said, you know what? You were a bigger person than I probably would have been because the only thing you texted me after the match, you did get to watch it live, which was probably very nice for you, but the only thing you did text me was the fact that you said condolences. So I give you props for being the bigger person and not rubbing it in. I'm not sure I would have gone the other way with that, but I get, maybe that speaks volumes about you and me. We had a lot of discussion yesterday, Scott. We didn't really talk too much about the Italian side of things, just about Gareth Southgate and the English side of things. But all this leads to the fact that I did my first training run yesterday for our bet. My body hurts this morning. My quads are sore. My calves are tight and my back hurts. This sucks.
How many miles did you run yesterday in preparation for the beer mile? Did you just do one? Were you just doing laps to see how you'd feel after each one? Where did you go with this?
Well, here's the thing. I haven't run probably since last April, I want to say. You know, the pandemic hits and the gym's closed and my spin class is closed. And I thought, I'm going to buy some new runners and go out there and train. Well, that lasted all of probably about three training runs. I did 4 kilometers. Now, I posted a picture of the track. I didn't actually run the track because there was construction going on, so I just ran in and out of the neighborhood. So there were some hills involved. It wasn't exactly flat, but I did run 4 kilometers, and the first 3 kilometers I did without stopping. So I think that's good enough for a mile, right? 3 kilometers is more than a mile. So I think I'm kind of on the right direction.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know how one trains for a beer mile on the regular. Maybe you need to consult some experts on this. As we mentioned, this is a global competition. There are people that do this all the time. I would think that you'd have to consume a little beer somewhere along the way to properly train yourself.
So here's the thing. Yes, there is going to be some beer consumption at some point. Actually, well, here's the thing. My beer consumption is probably fine. I'm not sure I have to practice that. But when it comes to running and beer consumption, that's another story. Yesterday was all about just feeling out the waters of actually running again for the first time in over a year. As I said, the body's not exactly feeling too great today, but hopefully, you know, a little more Epsom salts and some stretching and foam rollers will make it feel a bit better. I don't want to say I'm confident because I'm not. I'm not confident that I can finish this without some beer coming up the other way, but I am prepared to do this bet and I'm going to put in some training runs just to see, you know, how the body feels and adjusts. And maybe, you know, by the end, I'll do 1 or 2 beers in preparation for the 4 I have to do when I complete this mile.
We're not going to spend the bulk of our time talking about Italy v. England. I didn't get a chance to comment on it yesterday. We'll ask Donovan Bennett about it because he was commiserating yesterday, I imagine, with three Lions supporters the same way you and Jamie were. I will say this. The dream start for England. Italy didn't look great in the first 20, 25 minutes of that match. I'll admit I was a little nervous. I was thinking about what I was going to have to do. But this Italian side, unlike Italian sides of the past, it's the one team I've seen in recent years where I went, okay, the one thing I know they can do is score. I worry about them actually trying to go down the road England went down, which is, hey, we got a goal. Let's just see if we don't have to press anymore. And boy, did England absorb pressure in that game. Italy finally got the goal. I was hoping they'd win it in regulation. It's pretty crazy, and maybe it's the most obvious prediction given the history of the nation that you support in these competitions. We had Brendan Morrison come on this show last Thursday. We had Craig Forrest come on this show last Friday, and both of them said the exact same thing. I just have a feeling that Italy's going to win this on penalties. I'm not sure that I've seen a more dramatic swings within a penalty kick competition than we saw in this one, because England had the early lead, then Italy were up, and it looked like they finished it off, only to see a save off the post and a third consecutive miss by an English penalty kick taker. I understand why Southgate's taking all of the flack. He's lived it before, albeit as a kicker instead of a manager. This is not going away anytime soon. And yet, as I said to one of my friends who I was watching this with, and he was in the minority, it was mostly Italian supporters where I was watching, I said, here's the hard part for you. This actually represents progress. The fact that England got to this match, the fact that England was this close, and yet it may never set up better again because almost every match, including this one, were played at home.
That was one of my points yesterday, was the fact that getting past the semifinals, getting to a international championship final for the first time since 1966 should be celebrated. It should. And a lot of players on this English team should be celebrated because they're set up for the future. Like, this core, or at least the nucleus that you hope going forward, is 19, 20, 21, 22. So there is a lot of positives to come out of that. But it's hard to fall back on the positives when the negative of losing at home in the penalty shootout after having a lead in the first 2 minutes of the game and the way that the game broke down. And it's just hard to focus on the, you know, in the immediate aftermath, and especially if you're an English supporter, and the British media, who we know, like, you talk about Canadian hockey media, just go over Britain and talk about the media over there, whether it be tabloids or sports. Like, they are just brutal and will eviscerate you over there. But I do think there's some positives. Scott, I will say this, like, watching that Italian side, once they gained their footing around, I want to say, the 30th minute, it was impressive to watch and fun to watch. Like, if it wasn't me on the other side cheering for the English squad, I was very taken away with how Italy pushed forward, just their ball possession, decisions on when to press, when to not. It was just a very tactical performance from them, so I can appreciate that. I do want to get your take, though, because this was the biggest story, right? Gareth Southgate's decision. First of all, with the substitutions, Grealish not coming on until the extra time, added time, and then putting two guys in who were cold mentally and physically to go take two penalty shots. For me, I didn't like those decisions. I get why he did go with Rashford and Sancho late in the game, but why not put them in earlier to get their, you know, feet underneath them, get some adrenaline going? You just mentally get yourself in the game. Also, push to win the game with two offensive players and maybe not go to penalty kicks. Like, just your opinion on that.
Yeah, I can understand why he's taken so much heat. And listen, this was purely penalty kick driven, and it's not as though they didn't practice this. It's not as though there wasn't reason to put these players in. But the point about them not being really warmed up, Rashford hadn't touched the ball. He hadn't touched the ball till he takes that kick. And man, it shows you, we love this term, fine lines, how close things are. He hits the post. If that is 2 inches more inside, it bounces off the post and goes in, and it's a perfect penalty kick. He did everything right except for just a fraction of that kick. And then the last two penalty kicks are no good. I think there's as much reason to get after Gareth Southgate for leaving Saka in the position he was in. He went with what had been done at the time, and it's really, it comes down to this, and it's funny because analytics and the eye test were back in the news yesterday when it came to hockey, and I'm not sure if we're going to get to that story today or not, but boy, those two communities were fighting. I thought we were past that debate in 2021, but there is this gut feel that comes with it. And what Gareth Southgate did, and this applies to every sport, what he did is say, here's what we've practiced, here's what we're going with. There were a lot of people who said, read the moment. Read the moment. And in that game, as good as Saka had been in the tournament, he didn't look comfortable in that game. And if he doesn't look comfortable in that game, do you leave him in the position that you've practiced, or do you say, I got to go with what I feel in this moment? It's a debate that will go on for years. Obviously, Gareth Southgate will wear this, but it was a spectacle. No one will forget it anytime soon. You're right. It was a great match for you, save for the result for me, combined with the result. It was a spectacle, though, and that's what penalty kicks are. We saw a spectacle last night. And as much as people have bemoaned Major League Baseball and some of the things that go with it, the Home Run Derby remains a spectacle, and it gave us some great moments again last night, didn't it?
It did. Like, it just even from the beginning and how it kicked off with Trey Mancini, the one leading it off, and he had a phenomenal, he made it to the final, and the story that goes behind him, you know, battling cancer. He missed all of last season. He's back with the Orioles this year, having a pretty decent season. Pete Alonso, the one repeating, I mean... Did anybody have more fun out there yesterday than Pete Alonso? I mean, the brashness of him, the confidence of him, it was just so fun to watch. I loved it from the kid because he's still young. He's still, what, making only $600,000 a year for the Mets? And then there's Shohei Ohtani, who was the show. You have to admit this. I was talking yesterday with Jamie and Greg, and I'm trying to say, like, is there any other thing to get invested for this Home Run Derby? Is there anything more than just Shohei Ohtani? And like, nope, it's just Shohei. Didn't get out of the first round, but... it didn't matter, did it? He was still just having him up there and being there. And maybe it did matter in the, you know, the fact that he didn't go as far and you couldn't use that storyline going forward. But like, everyone wanted to talk to him. Everyone wanted to see him. It was a fun event.
Yeah, it was. Shohei hits, what, six or was it five? 500-foot plus bombs. I think it was six that he hit last night. He was fantastic despite getting out of the first round. And that's part of the conversation, and we'll have one a little bit later in the show. I know you guys wanted to get there yesterday, but because of breaking news, you kind of got waylaid in terms of an all-time, if you could take players in their prime, plug them into a home run derby, who are the eight players you would select? We can have that conversation a little bit later on in the show, but it's also one of the unique things about the All-Star game and about this competition in general. Quite often, the winner isn't the biggest story. Now, the way that you describe Pete Alonso and the swagger and everything with the way it finished and the incredible run, he just hit bomb after bomb after bomb after bomb after bomb, and thank you, I'm done, walk it off, I'll take my second crown. And yet Shohei Ohtani is the story today, and we've seen this in previous years. Vladdy Guerrero Jr., he didn't win, but he put on the biggest show in the year where we all went, this kid is coming out of his shell, and now it's on. Josh Hamilton is a guy who's done this in the past. It's one of the great and unique things about the Home Run Derby that it's not always the winner that ends up being the lead the next day.
Well, and with Shohei Ohtani, I mean, the story is even just bigger than the Home Run Derby. I mean, he was the number one seed, and everyone knows going in how far and how dynamic he can be as a home run hitter. He's the last one to go. He's seen all these guys hit, you know, guys hitting 20, 30 home runs out of the park. And he steps up there, and it takes him a while to hit the first one, and he's hitting line drives, and then he's getting under the ball. He's trying to make some adjustments, and the first thing he does is move the cage a little bit, and everyone's saying, okay, he's taking this very seriously, like he wants to make sure everything is perfect. And he looked a little shy up there, almost like a, I'm sorry that I can't hit these home runs out. And he could have moved on. I mean, there were chances for him to do this, but he just kept getting that tying one with Juan Soto, who, by the way, I mean, he went in there just fearless, and he's like, nope, I'm not going to let Shohei Ohtani win this. I'm going to win this as the eighth seed. I'm still a good home run hitter. It was almost a... I didn't feel bad for him, because I don't. I just... it was like a... you almost... look like a little kid in his first experience at an amusement park, and you're looking around in awe, and you just don't know which ride to run. Like, if I can make some sort of comparison, he just looked like he was a little in awe last night, and to be the center of attraction for all these Major League Baseball players wanting to talk to you and meet you and get your picture, like, I can only imagine what sort of pressure that was on him, and I think that maybe translated a little bit into what we saw at the plate.
Yeah, maybe there's that, but I'll tell you this, if you're an Angels fan, I don't know how many out there count themselves as Angels fan. You have the two best players arguably in baseball when Mike Trout is healthy, and yet you don't have a good enough team around them to get them into the postseason. But if you're an Angels fan, what's the big fear always with the Home Run Derby? I don't want the guy to exert himself too much. Like, this might be the best case scenario where you go and have a great first round, but it wasn't quite enough, and you put on a show, and we can talk about how great you are, and yet there's no injury, there's no extra swings. Thank you very much. We'll see you tonight, and I love the tweak for tonight, and I hope this is something they adopt in Major League Baseball moving forward. The fact that Ohtani can start this game, hit leadoff for the American League, and when they take him out of the game as a pitcher, he's going to be allowed to remain in the game as a hitter. And normally that wouldn't happen. Everybody I've heard loves this. I know it applies to only one team right now in Major League Baseball, but I hope this is something they use with the regular rules moving forward.
I saw a tweet out there saying, in an alternate universe, don't we all wish that Shohei Ohtani could pitch to Shohei Ohtani at the dish? Like, wouldn't that be, like, the ultimate thing to see? Again, can't happen, obviously. He's the same person. But it just shows how important he is to the game of baseball that they're changing the rules to allow him to have more access to the fans and them get to see him more at the dish. I think it's spectacular. I've called him this before. I called him it yesterday. He's a unicorn, Scott. He literally is. Like, there's been nobody out there like him. I don't know if we're ever going to find anyone like him again. You might see more players try to do this, but this is stuff of little league. Like, you just don't see it anywhere else. And the fact that he's able to take it to the big leagues and do it in the All-Star game, I just think it's fantastic to watch and fantastic for baseball, who's struggling for fantastic stories.
And maybe we'll get another one tonight. It's Rintoul and Sermon breaking news off the top of the show with the Minnesota Wild and their buyouts. It's something we will hit next with Mike McKenna, who is in Nashville with a guy who finally called it quits today. You might have a little fun with that. It's up next right here on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Mike McKenna set to join us here in moments. We'll talk about the hockey news of the day, and there's a couple of different stories. There are a couple of different stories. You can always get in on this 960, 960 or 650, 650. It's Rintoul and Sermon. What we hadn't announced off the top, Karen, and Pekka Rinne announced earlier today, is that he is done and he and Mike have a connection. They were both drafted by the Nashville Predators at goalies. And as Mike joked on Twitter earlier today, their careers went in slightly different directions.
Yes, they did. Pekka Rinne retires as one of the, did we say, more dominant goaltenders during a certain period of time, Scott? I think that's fair to say. Won the Vezina back in 2018. That was, of course, the season that the Predators won the President's Cup but lost to Winnipeg in the second round. He, you know, was in net for 2017 when the Preds made their improbable run to the Stanley Cup Final. 396 wins, 60 shutouts. I'm sure Greg's a little bit more up on the Pekka Rinne overall as a goaltender. But I do think, like, when you watched him when he was in his prime, was he not one of the goaltenders, Scott, that you looked at and said, if you wanted any goaltender in the NHL right now to backstop you to one win, it was Pekka Rinne?
Well, it's interesting because the era he existed in, Karen, he played with some all-time greats. And there are guys who are going to the Hall of Fame, and Mike McKenna will have a better view of this than perhaps us. Is Pekka Rinne a guy who is a lock for the Hall of Fame? We get into this discussion all the time of Fleury. Where does Pekka Rinne stack up? If Pekka Rinne existed in that spot, Karen, I don't think he stood there for long as clearly above everybody in the National Hockey League. I do agree there's a time when that was a conversation, and there were times in his career where he was extremely dominant. They didn't always match up with team success for the Nashville Predators. But we'll get Mike's opinion on that. Another Nashville Predators draft pick joining us now, television analyst for the National Hockey League, and of course, and once we get him on the line, we will get his opinion on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, Scott, you were just cutting out there, but we'll get Mike McKenna talking about that. I know Mike, too, also wants to talk about the fact that there's the Jack Eichel talks out there, Scott, and I'm just curious to think, with all the big moves that we're seeing right now, and we've talked about, you know, Bill Guerin and Minnesota just made some massive moves, and is that because of where they position themselves in the Central Division and where he sees them going forward, or is it more just because he's got to sign a couple of guys this season? When you look at Jack Eichel, like, is there the Vegas talk that he could actually be going there? Do they have the assets? Do they go out and get assets and make trades? What about the salary cap? Like, Vegas, to me, is such a curious team because the expectations with this team, I think, going forward are probably always making a run in the Western Conference Final. When you look at the Pacific Division, like, they're going to be the top team, or at least odds-on favorite to be the top team in that division. So do they need to go out and get a Jack Eichel, only because it's not competing in the division, but it's competing with the Western Conference?
All right, Mike McKenna is ready to go. It sounds like it was a technical glitch on my end as we tee up our Tuesday regular former NHL goaltender and NHL television analyst Mike McKenna joining us. Mike, thank you very much for doing this. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing all right. Yourself? Glad to be on, as always, on a nice Tuesday morning. It's overcast here in St. Louis. It rained about 5 inches the last couple of days, so a little bit of the opposite effect of what I came from in Las Vegas, where it hasn't rained and gotten enough rain out of California and the drought, and just a little different, man. So hanging out here, let's talk some hockey.
Yeah, let's talk some hockey, and we will get to the Vegas Golden Knights at some point during this conversation. But let's start with a guy you know quite well. He is Pekka Rinne. You were both in the Nashville Predators organization together. I don't think there's any question he is the best player that franchise has ever had, and he will be at the top of that list right now. Is he a Hall of Famer in your mind?
I don't think so, and that's so loaded because it feel like goaltenders never get the recognition that they deserve. If you don't win a Stanley Cup, you can't go in the Hall of Fame. If you don't win a Vezina, you can't go in the Hall of Fame. We were even having that conversation about Marc-Andre Fleury recently. Is he a Hall of Famer? 3 Stanley Cups. You know, he started for 1.5 of those, and he didn't win a Vezina until this past season, which seems insane. You know, it's somebody in the top 5 in wins all time, and you flip that to Pekka Rinne, and his career statistics are just incredible. 369 wins, a .917 save percentage, in the playoffs for almost every season of his career. Unfortunately, I think that his playoffs probably overshadow his regular season at times. A couple of epic meltdowns from the media's perspective, it felt like, where Pekka just couldn't seem to get across the finish line and get a Stanley Cup, or truthfully even perform up to his own standards later as it got into playoffs. And sometimes those are the things that end up defining your career, 2 or 3 games on the big stage rather than the entire body of work. So when there's people on the outside looking in, like Tom Barrasso and Mike Vernon, that have 2 Stanley Cups apiece, it's tough to look at Pekka and say a Hall of Famer. But without question, like you say, the greatest Predator of all time, a guy who, you know, we came in together. He was an 03 draft. I was a 2002 draft. And jokingly, they signed him and not me. And it looked like it was a pretty good decision. And Pekka's probably made about $60 more million than I ever did in my life. So good for Pekka, good for the team, but ultimately just an phenomenal guy, and really happy to see his career end in such a cool way. A shutout on home ice, the last game he played in front of those fans, just very fitting.
And I'm guessing that if I'm Pekka Rinne, I want everyone to specify I'm the greatest Nashville Predator of all time, not the greatest Predator of all time, because that can go a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, let's make sure we clarify that, please. We don't need Pekka Rinne getting canceled because of that. So that, thank you. I appreciate that, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I want to get to the other big news of the day. You raved about the Minnesota Wild this year, and boy, what a test they gave the Vegas Golden Knights in the first round of the playoffs. They had a fantastic season. Breaking news this morning, Zach Parise, Ryan Suter, both being bought out. That comes with large cap hits, combined cap hits in years 2, 3, and 4 after this coming season. How surprised are you, and what does it tell you about the direction of the Minnesota Wild?
It really surprised me because it's such a big swing. You're dealing with a lot of dead cap space down the road, which is always tough to deal with. But, you know, you reach a certain tipping point with an organization. What direction do you need to go? You know, is this going to weigh heavy against us having players who are still good NHL hockey players? I mean, try to tell me Ryan Suter's not still a top defenseman in the league and that Zach Parise doesn't bring value to a team. They do, but they don't at their cap hit. And buying them out, you're still going to have to eat some of that, but it does give the team flexibility. It gives them a chance to really run at Kaprizov, who's been overseas in Russia, taking a look at what's available, it seems like. Obviously, he's leveraging and posturing. We've seen this before, but it's real. You know, you've got a chance to land a Jack Eichel if you got enough cap space. You know, it gives you an opportunity to go for players that at this stage of the game can give you more value in terms of what their contract is. I do think the Minnesota Wild are really going to miss Ryan Suter. I think Zach Parise was better at times this year than he was allowed to show, and he will give value to somebody down the road. But but it's a huge swing. And it's a gutsy move by Bill Guerin. And I tell you what, I love that. I love having a general manager who's not afraid to make a decision. That's not easy, man. Like, it's, you got franchise defining players that you're moving out the door. And you got to admire somebody who's willing to take a chance like that to try to make the team better in any way that he sees fit.
Mike, I want to talk to you a little bit just about what you said right there, especially with Ryan Suter, because he was third on ice time in the Minnesota Wild this season. He played some heavy minutes for them, played in all 56 games, 22 minutes per game. Yeah, he's 36-year-old. There's going to be some left-side defensemen out there, but don't you think, after you watched him play numerous times this season, aren't there going to be a ton of people lining up to get his what he can bring to a team still, if it's a little bit at a cheaper price?
Yeah, well, I think it's still going to command a decent dollar. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think Ryan Suter's going to be signing a one-year, $1 million ticket with somebody. I would expect him to have a multi-year deal for pretty good money lined up. And, you know, typically when somebody gets bought out at a bigger stage like this, I think back to Vanilla Cavalier being bought out, he goes to Philly and signs another big deal. Like, the player ends up okay in terms of the money. You know, not that they were going to be in dire straits by any respect given their dollar figure and their income previously, but they end up pretty much made whole. And you know what, sometimes these are blessings in disguise. You know, you get a chance to move on to a team that can use you in a different role that maybe fits you a little bit better, that, you know, when you sign a contract 8 seasons ago was not the case, or was the case. And so things change, you know, and these long contracts, we've seen them. How many times do you get to the end of those where everybody says, well, this was a good deal, happy about it, let's move on? So often you get up past 7-8 years, and some of these old back diving contracts that we saw years ago before the last CBA, they've come back to haunt teams, and we're seeing it now. But you know, we are at a stage where I think that the management of these types of contracts are going to be better moving forward. But I do definitely think Suter's going to land somewhere, and I think Parisi will too. I don't know if he'll be a big dollar ticket by any stretch. I think he'll be looking for the right fit more than he will be for the right dollar amount.
Just some more breaking news coming in, and it's the fact that the Montreal Canadiens have given Dominique Ducharme a 3-year contract extension. They removed the interim tag. I think this was expected, but one thing that really struck me, Mike, in their postseason media talks was, like, they kept pointing to culture. And Jeff Petrie said, in all the years that I've been here, this is the best culture that we have. Eric Staal talked about culture. Corey Perry's talked about culture. And I'm not saying that that's a shot at the previous head coach, but I do think it's something, speaks something to what Dominique Ducharme brought to this team, and I can only imagine that that was a big weighing factor. Yeah, they got to the Stanley Cup final, but I'm sure in the exit interviews with Mark Bergevin, these guys are saying, like, we have a good culture in this locker room with this team. Like, how important is that, not just making a Stanley Cup final, but that right blend of culture and a head coach can bring to a locker room?
It's huge. It's massive and so hard to really quantify unless you're in the room. How much the coach is a part of that these days? You know, a lot of times, even in recent memory, the players operated very autonomously from the coaching staff. They were on their own. And in the past 5-6 years, you've seen coaching and the players become much more of a partnership than it's ever been. Not that you need to be friends, not that you have to go and have lunch every day and make it a big kumbaya type of moment around a campfire, but you need to be able to build a culture that you trust one another and that honesty is valued. And when people are friends with one another, when they know that they have each other's best interest at heart, it allows you to be open and honest. You know, it's just like your relationship at home with, you know, with your wife or with your husband. You have to be honest with one another to really know where you stand, and you have to communicate. And I look at somebody like Dom Ducharme. He's 48 years old. He's coached a major junior. He's had the experience of an assistant with the Canadiens. He's been successful wherever previously, but he's also somebody who comes from a scholastic background. He went to the University of Vermont, 4 years there. It's somebody who can obviously speak well across both languages and do what's needed to manage the Montreal landscape. I thought he did a great job with that team. When he started to get his claws into what the team could do, I thought Ducharme reinvigorated them. And I think that that culture, as you alluded to, was a really big part of that.
Mike McKenna joining us here as he does every single Tuesday, television analyst and, of course, a former NHL and AHL goaltender. We thought that Duncan Keith would be a little higher up the list when we began preparing for this show today, but because of all the breaking news we just talked about, we're finally getting there now. Was there any curious aspect of this trade with the Edmonton Oilers to you?
I'm not surprised that Keith's moving on, all the optics surrounding it, but it does feel like the Blackhawks got off pretty easy in this one, you know, I felt like Edmonton might have to give up a little bit more in the other direction to make it happen. And I guess it all depends on what Duncan Keith does in the next year or two here, right? If they go win a Stanley Cup, you look back and you think, okay, this was all worth it. But you got to look at the flip side of it, where sometimes you're paying for past experience, and that's different than what you're getting, you know, and you're hoping that somebody can reinvigorate and move on and move up and overtake what a lineup is. And to me, is Duncan Keith a top four defenseman in the NHL? Yeah, absolutely. Is he a top two any longer? I'm not sure that he's there. I like his game. I liked his game in the bubble for Chicago a couple of years ago, but I also thought that Keith was kind of the only guy they had, to be frank, and you had to trot him out and play those minutes. So If the Oilers are expecting a one or two guy, I'm not sure that's going to happen. If they can use Keith in a 3-4 and manage his minutes and let him keep his energy and do what he needs to, power play and everything else, maybe this trade looks good. But I sure thought that Chicago was going to be able to – was going to have to give up a little more to get this thing to happen, and it didn't happen. So, kudos to the Blackhawks on what seems to be a good deal for them, and I guess we'll see going forward for the Oilers what it looks like.
Yeah, I'm very surprised Chicago didn't have to retain salary in this deal. I think that's
correct.
The most curious part. And then when you hear more about the Caleb Jones part of it, people going, well, why are they giving Caleb Jones? And you find out that maybe Caleb Jones wanted a change of scenery. And Mike, you can speak to this because you've been in NHL rooms. We have not. If I see a Caleb Jones saying, you know what, a fresh start might be good for me. We hear about big names saying that. We don't often hear about guys where Caleb Jones is on the depth chart. You've been in those rooms. How many guys feel that way and would like to be in a different situation on any given roster?
I tell you what, it happens in the minor leagues too. I can tell you right now, I know of one very good hockey player in the NHL that demanded a trade while he's playing the American Hockey League. And you know what? It ended up working out for him. But I always look at those with trepidation. I always find when people start requesting trades, you're thinking, okay, well, are things just not good enough for this person? Why can't they work their way through it? Why do they have to be out of there? Now, of course, when you have a big contract, it's different. You can kind of call your own shots. But I think we have a double standard here, too. It's like, if you don't make a lot of money, if you're not a superstar, you should just shut up, put the gear on, play hockey, take your money, and be happy about it. And you know what, man? Sometimes people aren't happy. And if you're not happy, you got to take a gutsy swing. And you have a little bit of leverage as a player. You can ask to be moved. But what I always find nerve-wracking is that if you ask to get moved, you don't know what the context is going to be of that when you are a lower on the totem pole player. You might get thrown in as an extra piece. A team that you're headed to may not see you in the same light as the team giving you up if you're an ancillary part of a trade. It makes me nervous for players who aren't of huge stature when they request trades. You just never know. But there have been plenty of instances where it's worked out for them. So, you know, you can see it in both directions. But I do just think in general, man, like I think people need to be more open to realizing you don't have to be a superstar to get what you want in this world, like fans and media, you know, just take the money and shut up. Okay. That's not how this works. We're human beings too. We just want to be happy. And we all want to work in a situation that fulfills us, that makes us excited, and a place where we think that we can thrive.
Mike, one player that's obviously not happy and wants to be happy somewhere else or have a new lease on life is Jack Eichel. I mean, if you take out, I don't know if you can take out the health issues because of the fact that they're still lingering and we don't really know what the end game is going to be, whether it's surgery or not with Buffalo. But let's look at Vegas because they've been tied to him and we know about the cap issues last year. It was obvious, 15 players on the ice for that one of the final regular season games. But do you think Vegas being creative, Kelly McCrimmon going, okay, trying to get move assets out to move assets in that maybe Buffalo wants, like, do you see Vegas trying to make a hard push for that dynamic center that the, you know, we said was pretty much what was lacking for this Vegas squad.
If there's something shiny out there, Vegas is going to make a play on it. They'll at least be in talks. There's no reason to say that won't happen. It's happened on every single trade for a big name and every single free agent out there in the last 4 years, it seems like. Whether it's been Stone, Pacioretty, Petrangelo, these things happen. And if you've got a chance to improve your team, you have to look at it. And you've got a centerman in Jack Eichel who's as good as you're going to get. I'm not sure you can get anybody else in the league at this point, realistically, for what you could possibly get him for now. And I know there's things going on. There's the health concerns, everything else. Jack Eichel would make the Vegas Golden Knights better. He would, down the middle. They don't have the center depth. They have players coming along. Peyton Krebs is an intriguing prospect. Cody Glass hasn't played up to expectations. You know, you've got a couple of guys in Nick Waugh, who's probably a fourth liner, maybe can play third line minutes. Chandler Stephenson was great during the regular season, played hurt in playoffs. And Will Carlson's continued to put out respectable numbers as a misfits line with Stephen, or with Smith and Marchessault, but they could use a number one center. And Eichel's the best one out there. And realistically, we can think about cap implications and everything else that may factor into this, but when's the last time that mattered? You know, Alex Petrangelo was available. The Golden Knights went out and got him, and you take care of the salary cap down the road. So I do think there's a real chance that the Golden Knights make a play, at least trying to find out what it would take to get Eichel. Will he end up there? I don't know if they could swing it. I don't know if they have the prospects and the package to make that happen in comparison to other teams right now. But I definitely expect him to be in the conversation.
I'll take a look at the Tampa Bay Lightning quickly, of course, because I think they all understand, and they were saying it at their year-end pressers, the fact that, like, look, like, this is not going to be the same team next year. It has to make changes just because of the salary cap, and you're not going to have an LTIR Nikita Kucherov contract this year. So when I look at it, you're probably going to lose Barclay Goodrow. You're probably going to lose Blake Coleman. And even when you take those two guys off, there's still $5 million over the cap going into next season. What do you really realistically think is going to happen with this Tampa Bay team? And I did want to ask, just add this on, like, they're going to go to Steven Stamkos. Is there any way that he says, yes, I'll move my no trade clause?
I can't see it with Stamkos. I'd just be, I think there's still a hint of loyalty in this game, and knowing how the Tampa Bay Lightning operate, they're not afraid to make tough decisions. They're not afraid to have hard conversations. But after you win two Stanley Cups and your captain is the guy there, I don't know how you can push him aside. I really don't. And I just think there's a ripple effect to these things where you look at that and go, is this really where I'd want to be? I know that they've got to make really hard decisions. They're going to be way over. I can't help but think about Tyler Johnson, where he could potentially end up. And you do. You look at Goudreau and Coleman, and they were so important to that team. Both players who, you know, were somewhat unheralded before going to the Tampa Bay Lightning. I mean, I think Blake Coleman was a pretty well-known commodity, but Barclay Goodrow definitely upped his value. I just think that when you look at this, Tyler Johnson's definitely a target. I mean, can they keep Yanni Gord around? There's another $5 million bucks in the bank. Palat's at $5 million. You know, you've got really good players that could potentially go. I just can't see it being Stamkos. That's my gut feeling in way that, and I've been in that organization twice. I know people that play there, that work there. I'd be shocked if that's the route they went. But I tell you what, it's hockey. We never know what's going to happen. So it's very interesting to see. But no matter what the Tampa Bay Lightning do, as good a job as they've done developing players through the Syracuse Crunch organization, I wouldn't be surprised to see them contending for a third straight Stanley Cup next season.
Very quickly before we let you go, the Columbus Blue Jackets have been excellent at developing goaltenders. They have a choice to make with Merzlikins and Korpisalo when it comes to the expansion draft, unless they can move somebody by the weekend. What do you do if you're the Columbus Blue Jackets?
It's a tough one. To me, I'd like to keep both goaltenders. Now, I know they both have assets. I know they're both that, you know, they're in something of a rebuilding phase, obviously, and trying to bring that program back to where it was. But man, I like having the option of having two goaltenders there that can really play. I think that that's, you know, and let's put it this way too. Like, Korpisalo didn't have the season that he expected. Merzlikins, to me, differentiated himself this year. I think he took a step beyond and really began to take over that crease. And I think Korpisalo still has something to prove. The problem is that you look at what's coming from behind with Columbus, and, you know, the tragedy notwithstanding with Matisse Kivliniak's just awful. And it feels terrible that we're even talking about this, but I'm not sure Columbus goes out and gets a veteran to fill a spot if you move on a Korpisalo or Merzlikins. I don't know where they go with it. And I think it's manageable, the cap hit they have with them. I don't know how much value Korpisalo has on the market. I think Merzlikins has a ton. And I think that if you've got a player like that who can grow within your organization and project out even 3-4 years down the road when you get your franchise back to where it needs to be, Merzlikins to me is the type of guy that I think could carry you to a Stanley Cup. The swag he plays with, the skill set he has, he's your guy. He's the one I'd want to keep if you had to make that decision, but I'd like to bring them both back.
Well, I'm not surprised that your phone rang. It's going to be ringing a lot. You addressed this on Twitter, so we'll do it at the very end of this interview. I know you're not going back to the Vegas Golden Knights broadcast next season. That makes you a free agent, yep. And that phone's going to be ringing a lot, buddy. We're not letting you out of this contract, but I know there are a bunch of other offers coming.
We'll see. Yeah, I tell you what, I'm super grateful that Vegas believed in me and gave me the chance to start this career. I learned so much on air. I've said it before, you know, you start off and you jump out there without water wings in the deep end, and it's a big learning curve. And I just was really super grateful that they gave me that leash. They let me learn on air. We didn't have a negative conversation in 2 years. So, I'm thankful to them, and I don't know what's next. I've been in a UFA before. I'm a UFA right now. So, we'll see what happens, but I tell you what, you guys are still going to get me every Tuesday, and I'm looking forward to that.
As are we, and we're super awesome, grateful, Mike, that you continue this relationship with us. As I said, you can make your next announcement here. It's not going to be long. You're going to have choices, my friend. Thank you very much for doing this. Have a great Tuesday, and we will talk in a week's time.
Thanks,
Mike. That sounds great. Karen, Scott, be good. Talk to you next week.
That is Mike McKenna. Yeah, he broke that news a little bit earlier today, Karen, and we're going to have to make a quick turn because we have a guest at the top of the second hour, which we don't normally. Donovan Bennett's going to join us in just a few minutes' time, but I'm not surprised that Mike McKenna's phone's already ringing. I wouldn't be surprised if that's another team or a network calling him already. He is excellent, and he's on his way up.
It's funny. Maybe it's some breaking news. We had Mark Spector on yesterday, Scott. I don't know if you heard this, but his phone cut out for a minute, and he was saying it was Elliot Friedman that was calling him. And then we find out as soon as we get Mark Spector off the phone that Elliot breaks the news that Duncan Keith and the Oilers was imminent, and it all kind of went from there. So Mike McKenna's got some breaking news he wants to, or that he missed during this. We made him miss it with that phone call.
Well, maybe Donovan Bennett has some breaking news for us as well. Normally, our Monday regular jumps on to Tuesday, and he will jump on the line next right here on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
Thanks for joining us here on Rintoul and Sermon. Donovan Bennett will do so momentarily. Normally, on Mondays, he joins us on Tuesday. Lots to get into with Donovan, who was involved in the last Hockey Night in Canada opening of the season. I'm not sure how many people know that, Karen.
I'm not sure how many people do either, but I do believe they used my one of greatest comebacks in sports championship history, Scott, in that intro as well. I think I got a little, I didn't take any credit for it, but I think they were on the same page of what the Cleveland Cavaliers coming back, LeBron James leading the Gals past the Golden State Warriors. I believe that was in the intro as well.
Yeah, it most certainly was, and we will get to that here in just a second. Lots of text flowing in today. Wondering, people in Gibson's like Marcus wondering, hey, could Parise sign a Joe Thornton-style deal or Suter sign a Joe Thornton-style deal to play on a cup contender? That's possible, Marcus. I think that either player would argue he has more left in the tank. Certainly Suter would. I don't know about Parise. I guess we can have a conversation about that throughout the course of the show. And we will get to more hockey talk throughout the day. That's some pretty big news coming out of Minnesota. Yeah, I suppose that either of them could do that. Where are they at with how they feel about their personal finances? Sometimes, Karen, it's not even about, hey, I need to be paid this much. Sometimes it's about, you need to value me relative to my peers in the league, so I don't want to take the bargain basement price.
Yeah, and I don't think, Suter, let's just go with Ryan Suter at this point, because I think we believe that he still has the most in the tank left out of the two players. And, you know, he may not take the bargain basement. He may not be offered the bargain basement. But you look at Ryan Suter, he's still going to pay paid some money down the road with a $6-some-odd million still left owed to him, Scott, both of them actually. And you think to yourself, like, I've been with the Minnesota Wilds for 8 years now, the 13-year deal. I've won two playoff rounds in that time. So maybe you're a Ryan Suter and you look at, like, look, No, I don't want to be bargain basement, but I understand where the flat cap is. I've made my money through my career. I went home to Minnesota. You know, like it, all these things add up and you think, okay, now it's my time to go chase a cup. And if he has to go to a team and take a little bit less than maybe someone else offers, I could totally see that happening because his entire career, the longevity, and just how many more years he has left to go and chase that cup.
Someone else tweeting at us, would this perhaps make Minnesota a player in the Jack Eichel sweepstakes? Well, with the cap relief that Minnesota will get this coming season, perhaps. But boy, you got to be really confident in your capologist and how you perceive things moving forward and the portability of other contracts if you're finding a way to get him on board. I think that's pie in the sky, but who knows? Bill Guerin has been pretty aggressive during his time as Minnesota Wild GM. We'll get back to that conversation later in the show. As mentioned, our pleasure to welcome Donovan Bennett to these proceedings. He of Sportsnet, and we're going to go a bunch of different directions that do not include the Minnesota Wild. Donovan, thank you very much for doing this. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm wondering if that cloud that probably was over your head, over Karen's head yesterday, and the rest of the Three Lions supporters, has it dissipated whatsoever? Are you still in a fog? Where are you at after what transpired on the weekend at Wembley?
Yeah, well, I went from gutted at the results and maybe some of the manager's choices to disgusted at the response, the racial response, to, you know, the three penalty takers that missed for England, to, you know, optimistic at the response to the response and the love that, you know, many of the supporters of the England football team and just football in general have shown to, you know, Saka, Rashford, and Sancho. And so, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's football. It happens, and sports is a microcosm of life in general and a great teaching tool. And so I think we all learned some life lessons and got some perspective out of the results. So it didn't come home. It went to Rome. That's okay. They were the better team throughout the 90 minutes and throughout the tournament. But you know, I'm happy that, you know, these voices of loud few were shouted down by some allies.
And Donovan, I don't know about you, but I hope you didn't make any bets like I did. I have a beer mile that I have to am currently training for. If you'd like to fly out here and run it in solidarity with me, I'd be more than happy to have a partner in this bet. I wanted to, though, talk to you
would
about...
I struggle running a water mile, like with this H2O. So I'm hoping you're filming this so that we can see this content, but you're not getting a partner in solidarity for me, that's for sure.
Well, I don't blame you, because if I could somehow get out of this, I'd probably try my best. But I will hold my end of the bargain. I did want to talk to you, though, about something you had mentioned just off the end there. And the post by Marcus Rashford in after the missed penalties and all the, shall we say, hatred that's been thrown to him on social media, and not just specifically him, but I did want to talk to you about this post, because he had a, if you read the post, it's pretty heartbreaking, actually. He talks about he can score penalties in his sleep. It's been playing over and over in his head. He apologized. He said it wished it end differently. He had a little bit of a weird nagging feeling about it leading up to the penalty kicks, and just something felt off about it. And he said, I can handle the criticism if you want to criticize me about the penalty kicks and my soccer, but don't criticize me from where I'm from, the color of my skin, or how I choose to do my time, spend my time off the pitch, which is basically doing charity work in England. So I wanted to ask you about the way that he responded in devastation, but then also holding his head high.
Yeah, I mean, it showed the character that he's shown for a long time. The fact that Marcus Rashford is a professional footballer, one of the best in the world, certainly one of the best in England, found himself on that pitch, given, you know, he came from an impoverished background, given that nothing was given to him, like, he is a success story, no matter what, even if he, you know, missed that kick. But on top of that, what he did with his celebrity and his platform in the UK, making sure that millions of kids that were food insecure, like he was when he was young, got meals during the pandemic when they were out of school. The government said they're not going to continue to feed them lunches. And he brought that to attention and said, this is unacceptable. When the government refused to step up, he said, fine, I will raise the money and I'll feed them myself. And eventually, because of public pressure, the government went on board. no matter what he does on the football field, he's a saint and a savior in that community. And so the fact that all of that was forgotten so quickly, and it was just down to his physicality and people crushing him because he wasn't able to execute physically, and not thinking about he was able to execute with his heart and his mind for the betterment of people that weren't himself. I love the fact that he was so classy in his response, and I love the fact that his mural, which was defaced, has been a place where people have gone to write him messages about what he, the symbol of him, means to them. So it started, you know, negatively, but it's turned around full circle, and it's reminded me that there are so many positive people out there.
There are, and I saw some of the handwritten letters that you just mentioned for some kids that were out on social media, and it's nice to know that the good stories are still being put out there on the social platform. In terms of on the pitch, I mean, I guess it should be celebrated the fact that England got to a international championship final. That hadn't happened since 1966, but, you know, you're at home, you're at Wembley, and the way the game went, it's hard in the moment to celebrate what England did, but England supporters, you and me going forward, like, there's a bright future with this club, is there not?
No question. And listen, anyone supporting this club would have taken this result. If we said a couple weeks ago, given the questions about this team, and given the biggest question was about how they were going to be at the back defensively, that they were only going to concede two goals from open play, that they were going to win their group top, beating Croatia, a team that has had their number historically. They're going to beat their rivals, not just historically, but in soccer, in Germany, in the knockout phase. They're going to go all the way to the final and win in kicks, and they're going to restore some of the football pride in that nation. Everyone would have taken it, because this team, to your point, is a bit ahead of schedule. The thought was maybe get to a final in the World Cup, and I would argue it's harder to get to a final and win the Euro Cup because of the depth of talent than it is the World Cup, even though that's antithetical to think about. But given the ages of Sancho and Saka and Rashford and Luke Shaw and on and on and on, the balance of this team, the entire 11 that you saw take the field, and you could argue the entire 26 that was there, are going to be eligible come a year and a half when we're having a World Cup at Christmas time for reasons that we won't get to here. Not to mention the others that are coming up, like a Mason Greenwood, that are pushing this group. So the types of players that we're seeing coming through, they're young, they're bold, they're technically sound, and they play with flair. And there are so many of them. So, yes, if you are a Three Lions fan, you should be bullish that come World Cup time, Jack Grealish and Phil Foden and Calvin Phillips are going to be in their prime, and they're going to be better for this experience. So they are ascending, certainly, as a football squad, no doubt.
In conversation with Donovan Bennett, as we are weekly, this time on a Tuesday instead of a Monday. Donovan, we referenced this coming into the interview, that you had a lot to do with the final Hockey Night in Canada opening this year because it featured LeBron James, and you got to be a big part of that interview. I'm sure you've talked to young people trying to get into this industry in the past, and one of the questions that comes, who's the biggest person you've ever interviewed? Were you ever starstruck? And probably you haven't been starstruck very often. I don't know if this falls into that category or not, but what was the experience like interviewing LeBron James?
It's bucket list. There's no question, right? There's a small amount of people that, you know, I would say that's the person I got to interview. And LeBron was on that list. I've been lucky enough to interview Steph Curry, who would be on that list. In terms of just superstardom, I've been lucky enough to interview some big stars, no matter where you are, whether it's a Michael B. Jordan or a Ben Affleck, but LeBron is LeBron, and now he's not just arguably the best basketball player in the world. He's also a leading man in the film, so to be able to kill two birds with one stone in this interview was awesome. And even listening to you say it, LeBron James voiced the open for Hockey Night, I almost had to shake my head, because you'd never think that you'd see it or hear it, but we did. And on Thursday, many across this country will be able to see and hear me interview LeBron, talking to him about his film, Space Jam, A New Legacy, and talk about his legacy that he's leaving, not just as a basketball player, but as an entertainer, as an entrepreneur. He's such a fascinating guy. So I was really lucky and honored that we were able at Sportsnet to be the ones in Canada to get down and get some time to talk to him.
Well, and this is the bigger conversation about LeBron for me. It's no longer about the debate with Michael Jordan. Quite frankly, that's never going to be settled. You're either going to be on one side of that or the other, and it'll be a debate for the existence of time. But LeBron James falls into this category of superstar athlete who could have a bigger legacy than simply his athletic achievements. Do you believe that will in fact be the case 20 years from now?
No question. And I think the more appropriate comp, when it's all said and done, is we'll be comparing LeBron James and Bill Russell, or LeBron James and Muhammad Ali. I think LeBron James is going to be one of those people that university students have their poster, if posters are still a thing, probably NFTs, on their wall, right? One of those symbols for more than just what they did in sports or entertainment and music. I think LeBron is already there, and it's going to be the case for people who never have seen him play, who maybe will only have a memory of him through film as this movie continues to age. And yeah, what he's done in terms of opening a charter school and funding it, making sure that people in his community get free education, making sure that he's brought other people up with him. His best friends are his agent and his executive producer, and really providing an opportunity. If you look at all of his businesses, they don't look like what most Hollywood entertainment production companies look like. They are inclusive and diverse, both in age and gender and ethnicity. And so I think he's going to be a symbol for a lot more. And it's hard to really fathom this now because so many athletes are speaking up on so many topics. But LeBron James was doing it years ago when it wasn't as commonplace, when it wasn't as acceptable. And I think he realized, I own my own media company. Who is going to take opportunities away from me? I have a lifetime deal with Nike. Who am I worried about? And when he was able to do it without consequence, a bunch of other athletes said, all right, well, maybe I should make it part of my brand and speak to the issues that matter to me as well. And so I think ultimately that's going to be LeBron James' legacy, is that he never shut up and dribbled. He was able to use his voice in many ways.
I wanted to ask you, Donovan, about Shohei Ohtani, because I saw this tweet from Marley Rivera, who works for ESPN. She was actually at the All-Star game last night, and Vladdy Guerrero Jr. asked her to ask Shohei Ohtani's interpreter to introduce them, and they got a picture together, and he just wanted to speak to Shohei Ohtani. And usually Vlad, he's the young superstar too, and you think people want to get pictures with him, but no, it was he wanted to meet Shohei and have a few words with him. But doesn't this just speak to, when Shohei Ohtani, the things that he's doing in baseball right now, it makes other players just become fans of him as well?
No question. He's a living legend. And what he's doing is so improbable that there is a bit of mythology around him already, even though he's still a current athlete. I'm sure you both heard the recent conversation. Oh, he doesn't take batting practice, and he's crushing this way. Well, no, he doesn't take BP when everyone else does, but he's hitting, behind closed doors out of a cage. He's still getting his swings in. Just because he's a pitcher, he doesn't do it at the same time. But everything he does now is must-see TV with a little bit of intrigue around it. How is this possible? How is he doing this? This is so antithetical. And how at all were there some teams who said, we're interested, but only if you commit to just pitching and not being a field player? Because his bat is, to me, the most impressive part of the entire package. So when you've got high-level athletes who know exactly how difficult it is to do what he's doing, for sure they're going to be a little bit giddy around him and want to figure out what his secret is, but really just want to get in his proximity, because we may never, ever see someone have a season and a start to a career in Major League Baseball the way Ohtani has thus far.
Donovan, you are a man of many jobs, and you know so much about many sports, which is one of the reasons we love having you on this program, and I know how close the CFL is to your heart. Big football fan in general. Stephen Brunt, this is a little bit of a spoiler alert coming up next segment. We're going to play the clip he had on 960 this morning. And they got into a discussion on that program about whether or not the CFL needs Toronto. This has really been a discussion for years, for decades, in fact. And there are some who believe the league can't exist without that market. And there are others who say the market doesn't support it. Why don't you just go somewhere else? Where are you at on the future of the CFL and the inclusion of Toronto in that future?
So I think you could reframe the question and ask, does Canada need Toronto? And I know many people across our country hate Toronto, and they think that Torontonians only know of Toronto and think that everything that happens in the country is just from Bloor Street to Lakeshore in Toronto. And, you know, many people, those assertions are correct. We do think that we're another American city and not part of Canada. But most importantly, when you look at commerce, how important that is in southern Ontario for the rest of the country, it is important for Toronto to continue to produce financially. And that's the exact same equation in the CFL. So, yes, when you watch games at BMO Field or Rogers Centre beforehand and you see empty stadiums and really see apathy, and when you listen to talk shows in Toronto and you don't see the Argonauts or the CFL at large being part of the conversation, it begs the question, well, why do we even need the Argos, who are dragging everyone else down? But where they're not dragging people in the CFL community down are in two very important areas. One, gate numbers are just one thing, and yes, specifically in the CFL, they're very important, but the Argos historically have rated very well on television, and your television partner is someone you need to please all of the time, which is why I've always argued that there are Argos fans. The numbers, the TV numbers show what they are. They just need to do a better job of getting them to feel so engaged that they come to the park, they are excited, they're wearing Argos colors across the city, and that's a disconnect that they haven't been able to do. TFC, on the other hand, many people are like, TFC is thriving, and they are, and in stadium, it's a great event, but their TV numbers are not nearly as good. So both leagues would love to have the other's problem. That's one. The other is, when you look at the national sponsors for the CFL, where are all of their home offices? They're mainly in Bay Street. Most of them are in Toronto. So it's still important to have a presence in this city, to have relationships in the city, and ultimately we'd be better off if football was thriving in this city, because it would be easier to get some of those corporate partners. And so I think it's bigger than a Toronto issue. It's a big city issue. It's a Montreal issue. It's a Vancouver issue. Both of those cities, or all three of those cities, I should say, also have MLS franchises, similar types of leagues, similar types of fan bases, which have cannibalized some of the success in the CFL with those markets. But I do believe that for the CFL to thrive, both in the short and long term, Toronto has to be a part of the equation.
Donovan, appreciate your opinion on all of this. Thank you very much for doing this once again. I hope you have a fantastic week, and I look forward to reconnecting next week.
Thanks, Donovan.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Good luck with that beer mile. I'll be praying for you.
You'll be watching the video online.
I hope so. Make sure you capture it.
Oh, we will. We will. That is Donovan Bennett of Sportsnet, and there's a bunch of different things we get into there. What a very cool opportunity for him to interview LeBron James as part of that Hockey Night in Canada opening. And I do want to have not necessarily a complete, played-out, in-depth conversation about what Brunt and Pinder were talking about this morning in Calgary, and Donovan was just talking about there, but this issue continues to rear its ugly head, and I think there's a good case to be had on either side. And the way this morning is going, Karen, we may have more breaking news by the time we get back from this quick timeout. It's Rintoul and Sermon, and what they're saying is coming up next.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
What do they say? Put it out there into the universe and it will come right back to you. Just put the ideas out there. We did that. Hey, maybe we'll have more breaking news. I'm not sure we can put this in the same category as the Minnesota Wild buying out Parise and Suter today, something we will talk about throughout the course of the morning, or Pekka Rinne announcing his retirement. Not that you and I asked for either of those things. But we did ask for some more breaking news, and we sort of have some. We at least have the potential for some breaking news down the road.
Yeah, we do. This just tweeted out from Richard Zisman, who's a legislative reporter in the Vancouver area with CBC, I believe, Global News. Questions for Premier Horgan now, first in Vancouver, hosting the 2026 World Cup Games, because we know that Montreal has removed itself as a potential, or a host city, rather. He says, BC is in a totally different place now and sounds like Vancouver is back as a possible host city. Not there yet, but he did say that preliminary discussions have happened. So you and I discussed this when Montreal first removed themselves as a host city. That left Edmonton and Toronto as the only two, and we all know the reasons why Vancouver said originally they didn't want to. And now it looks like the landscape has changed. And I'm looking at this, Scott, as not how much it's going to cost to put these games on, but I'm looking at this in 2026. You are 5 years from now. You're post getting out of your post-pandemic issues economically, and this is a way for them to recoup as a province and as a city a lot of money that's been lost over the last couple of years.
Let's see where this goes. I feel like I sort of said this last week, 2 weeks ago, whenever the Montreal news came out. I've been of this feeling for a very long time, and a lot of that had to do with Victor Montagliani, who's the head of CONCACAF and serves a very high role up in FIFA as well, left the door slightly ajar. He was on recently in the last couple of months saying, hey, we're getting close to the ship sailing, but we've seen things change in the past. Look, Karen, a week and a half ago, we thought Montreal was hosting games in the 2026 World Cup. And all of a sudden, Montreal's not hosting games. So things can change in a hurry. I still think that we end up with World Cup games on the West Coast. Maybe that's pie-eyed optimism. I just think there's too much of an opportunity here, and there's too much desire from people in Vancouver, in the province of BC, Western Canadian soccer fans who would love to commute into a beautiful city and see some world-class games. And I also think on the part of FIFA, it's not just one-sided here. This is a desirable location, and a lot of it has to do not just with the city itself, the geography and being close to Seattle and having a whole West Coast aspect to the World Cup in 2026.
Like you said, it's a world-class city. It's a destination for people to come to visit. And if you're going to include possible soccer matches from different countries in that, I think it'd be a huge boon for the economy of British Columbia. It was a huge mistake when the BC government decided that it was not going to go after hosting potential World Cup games. It was. The city can handle it hotel-wise. The venue itself can handle it. We've seen World Cup qualifying games. We've seen Women's World Cup. I do wonder if there will be any pushback about the turf on it. You know, I know the female soccer players were outspoken a little bit about it before the Women's World Cup, but they did eventually play on it. And, you know, it's not as much of an issue as it has been in the past. Like, you know, David Beckham not coming to play here, or Thierry Henry not wanting to come play on turf. I think it's more of a moot point now than it was. But, I mean, it's still something that may have to be overcome obstacle-wise. But I do think this is a smart move from the BC government.
Well, at least leave the door open. Hey, we're having a conversation about it, and maybe it leads to something down the road. It's Rintoul and Sermon. I don't know if we call this breaking news, but we heard of the lengthy list, and it's a lengthy list, as it is every single time, of Tampa Bay Lightning injuries. Victor Hedman was among them. We heard broken hands when it came to the likes of Barclay Goodrow and Blake Coleman. We knew Nikita Kucherov was playing with a rib injury, and to no one's surprise, he was wearing a flak jacket after he took that hit from Scott Mayfield. He was getting it numbed before every game. We didn't get the exact ointment used or the exact freezing element used. That doesn't surprise anyone. Victor Hedman was playing through a torn meniscus as well, and cue the jokes, Karen. Everybody's making them right now.
Sean for Waterloo into the inbox. Hedman torn meniscus surgery, $7.875 million to the LTIR until the 2021-22 playoffs. Julien Brisebois did come out and say that they don't expect there to be any lingering effects come start of training camp. He expects him just to be fine. The one that I found interesting was just the way Julien Brisebois reacted to Alex Killorn, because we all know he broke his fibula. The next day, he got a rod put in. I believe he said this was Tuesday, Wednesday, Monday, Tuesday, whatever it was. And then by Saturday, just a few days later, he was back skating with the team in the hopes that he could get back on the ice and play in the Stanley Cup final. He said that was his, with Kyle Bustakas, Sportsnet reporter on the ice after the game. He said his goal was to get back in here. And Julian Brisebois was reduced to almost tears at the press conference, just talking about the fact he tried really hard to get back in. And does this, the reaction by Brisebois, who knows that this team is going to dramatically change, and the fact that when you take Barkley Goudreau off and Blake Coleman off, you're still about $5 million over the cap. Well, you look at Alex Killorn's cap hits. You know, there was rumors that Nashville was interested in him last year, but they were able to keep him in Tampa Bay. Does the reaction to you with the emotional of Julian Brisebois, does that lead you to believe that he understands that this was this guy's chance to get the Stanley Cup and that maybe he's not there last year? Is that reading too much into it, or is it just, do you think that there's some, that that could be something that is actually true?
Be interesting to watch Tampa Bay moving forward, Karen. I mean, there's so many deck chairs that need to be moved around, and how do they do it financially? It's one of the great mysteries of this offseason, and the other opportunity that exists for other teams out there. Let's not discount that. And that opportunity exists this week. Can you go out? Can you take advantage of this situation? And what's it going to cost you? Can you be that team? And look, I know it hasn't worked out with Nate Schmidt, for example, in Vancouver over this past year from his point of view and maybe from the club's point of view. I don't know for sure that he's moving on to another team, but Jim Benning was able to take advantage of an opportunity there last year and at the time applauded for it. Now, people may view that a little differently. He gave up a third-round pick and got what he believed was a pretty quality defenseman. I don't know that Schmidt plays for them moving forward, but it's just an example of a team needs to do something. Can you take advantage? Can you find a way to get in on that? Whether you're Calgary, Vancouver, you name it. It's a lot different than the trade that went down between the Oilers and the Blackhawks, where the Blackhawks are looking to do something. And hey, the Oilers, the proof will be in the pudding. They got eviscerated by a certain amount of audience yesterday. Yeah, maybe it improves your team. Maybe it brings in some experience. You should have been able to do this deal for less. You get the right results, that goes away. You don't, you're always going to be tied to it. In fact, there are some people, it doesn't matter if you get the results, they're always going to say, you overpaid, I'm never coming back from that.
What's apparent with, first let me touch on the Tampa Bay Lightning there, Scott, just because I just wanted to say, like, the one thing that I do think, and yes, you could get some good players that are going to be available. There are good players that are going to be available. Julian Brisebois is going to have to move on from the price. It's just wondering what the price will be, because the general managers are not going to be doing Julian Brisebois any favors at this point, right? Like, I mean, they're just not going to. You've won the Stanley Cup back-to-back years, and whether some GMs think it or not, I mean, you were lucky with the cap, and you used it to your advantage in the playoffs, and I just don't think people are going to be running to the door to take players off their hands for a cheap price. When it comes to Duncan Keith and the Edmonton Oilers, so when this was coming down yesterday, Scott, I'm thinking, okay, like, Caleb Jones and a third, right? Like, there has to be some salary retention. And we were talking about it. I'm thinking, okay, this is a decent deal. I mean, yeah, if they can, you can get Duncan Keith at 2.5 or whatever the case is, that's fine moving forward. If he can be put in the right position, maybe he's no longer, well, he won't be in the first pairing unit with Edmonton. That's Darnell Nurse's minutes. You know, you fit him with Adam Larson. If the Oilers can figure out a way to re-sign him, it kind of makes sense. But the no salary retention, it just, for a guy who's 37, turning 38 on Friday, all of the, do you want to say, underlying numbers point towards him not being as effective as he was a few years ago and trending in the wrong direction. For me, it's a heavy price, but it's a price you pay, I guess, when you talk about intangibles. And Ken Holland talked about this. Like, this is, yes, a player that he still thinks can perform on the ice in the right position. But how many times did he talk about character and Stanley Cup pedigree and bringing that to the locker room? Like, he harped on that. This is a guy that the Oilers went after and they said, 5.5, just over 5.5. It's worth it for us.
You just mentioned it, so let's get to it right now. Ken Holland starring today in what they're saying. There were a lot of people questioning a couple of aspects of this trade. So let's hear part of the back and forth the general manager in Edmonton, Ken Holland, had with Daniel Nugent-Bowman about the Duncan Keith trade yesterday.
So, you know, it seems like Duncan Keith, he really wanted to be in this geographic area, to be closer to his son. You know, obviously you seem to really value him as a player and why you acquired him. But was there a case to be made for potentially trying to put the hammer down a little bit more because you were one of only a select couple or few teams to that he was even interested in going to.
Well, do you want me to get him for free?
Not for free. No, I just wonder if there was, it was very,
I mean, you wanted a lesser price. Did you want, you didn't want Caleb Jones. You don't want the draft pick. You want them to retain 50%. Where are you going with, which would you like me to do?
I'm just curious.
You're asking me the question. You're asking me something about did you want me to try to get them to retain money, or did you think I paid too high a price with Caleb Jones on a third round pick?
Well, the salary, as Jason Greger brought up earlier, and I guess the salary retention is the biggest one, more than anything you gave up. So I guess
Daniel, my answer would be, Caleb Jones hasn't yet established himself as an everyday defenseman in the National Hockey League. He was in and out of our lineup. He shared time with Chris Russell and Lagesson and William Lagesson, and then we got Kulikov at the deadline. So I don't think he played a playoff game. So he's still trying to establish himself. So I traded a young defenseman. We've got Broberg, we've got Samarukov. Both are left shot, probably play left defense. Broberg can play either side. So we're trading a young defenseman away that hasn't yet established, and a third round draft pick.
There's no winning the argument today. There's no winning the argument today. All Ken Holland can do a year from now is point to the scoreboard and say it worked out. Or he'll take more heat because Duncan Keith doesn't perform particularly well in Edmonton, and Chicago's able to do further moves after this, and they look like the big winner in all of this. Or Caleb Jones blossoms into something in Chicago that he wasn't going to become in Edmonton because of the way they view him on the depth chart. The thing for Ken Holland that I imagine is frustrating, and you can be a believer in this trade, you cannot be a believer in this trade. Reporters and fans, we don't have to keep scoreboards, right? We don't have to. We get to be pretty critical of things like this, and we don't have to say, well, 15 times I was right, 10 times I was wrong, I win.
Yes, and Ken Holland's the one that has to sell Daryl Cates on this, and Ken Holland's the one that has to sell Dave Tippett on this, and Ken Holland's the one that ultimately his job is on the line with the moves that he makes. The age is the issue. The cap hit is an issue. Actual real dollar figures is actually pretty cheap. I think it's 3.1 over the next two seasons. So maybe Daryl Cates is looking at this and saying, well, I don't have to pay a guy a whole ton of money. Real money, cash. So Ken, you figure it out with the salary cap because I'm cash strapped and this is a real thing. Like, I need to have a savings on this. I don't know if Daryl Cates is saying he's a very rich man, and I don't know what his finances took this season in the pandemic, but maybe that's a thing. They're going to get some cap relief likely with Oscar Klefbom going on the LTIR. Like, the chances are, he said very slim to almost none, him playing next season from that shoulder injury. You're also thinking, too, that you're probably going to have a couple of guys, if not one for sure, on their ELC on the blue line. You look at it, Evan Bouchard, he can come in and hopefully take a next step. So you've got some cash savings there. But I understand, like, the cap retainment and the salary retainment from Chicago, I was aghast at it as well, and I'm still going to probably say that Stan Bowman fleeced Ken Holland for this, but until we see the results of what Duncan Keith can do in a second pairing role, and what he can do in reduced minutes, and not going up against the top net line, not getting the hard minutes for the Edmonton Oilers like he did in Chicago, I guess that's when we can really evaluate this trade. But I will be on record in saying I do think that Stan Bowman won this one.
Yeah, in a year from now, we might feel differently. If Caleb Jones doesn't crack that lineup, if Duncan Keith helps the Edmonton Oilers win multiple playoff rounds, and that's what makes it fun. Okay, here's what I felt at the time. Am I going to back off? There's a JT Miller trade's a pretty good example of this. How can you pay that price? A year later, a lot of people went, got to admit, I'm okay with it now. I'd do that deal again. And there were others, Karen, and people are like this. Nope, I still think it was too high a price. I wouldn't do that deal. Yes, it's a good player, and yes, it had a great impact on the Vancouver Canucks, but I'll never back down from the fact that that price shouldn't have been paid.
Yeah, and I mean, the Oilers have done this before and they've gotten ripped, right? Like, look at the Taylor Hall for Adam Larson trade, but Larson's been a big piece to them. That 1 year that they got him the next season, they actually went to the second round of the playoffs. Since then, it's been a lack of playoff success, but Larson has been a big piece of a shutdown pairing and important to this Oilers team, and we all know where Taylor Hall's career could have gone. Could he have a better career on the wing of Connor McDavid? Maybe, but hindsight, you can't really go back. It's just... It all boils down to money and age and performance on the ice. And if the... Ken Holland has a lot more things he has to do this season, Scott. He still needs to upgrade at wing. He still needs to find a third-line center. What the heck are they going to do in net next year? So he's got some money to play with this offseason, but it's not really this season that matters. It's next season when you're going to have to give Nurse his extension. And Puljujarvi you're probably going to have to sign if you contend him. So it's Ken Holland kind of... I can see why he's getting... ripped, shall we say, by the Edmonton media and fans, and I include myself in one of those.
We got this coming in from Minor Matt. Well, what about the third round pick that can be turned into a second? That gets turned into a second if the Oilers go to the Stanley Cup next year.
Yep. And Duncan Keith is what, fourth in time on ice or second highest defenseman in time on ice? There's a lot of stipulations, but the biggest one, Scott, would be the fact that Edmonton make the Stanley Cup finals, and I highly doubt that's happening. This one just comes in too because this is real. Rumor is a recapture after this season if Keith retires. Negative cap for the Oilers. Yes, that is a thing. I don't think that's the biggest reason for Ken Holland, but if he does retire, the Oilers have what is a saving of $3.7 million, and then Chicago takes on the penalty of the cap recapture.
Keep those texts coming in, 960, 960, 650, 650. More from the hockey world, Frank Saravelli, NHL insider. The Tarasenko situation remains out there. We talk about these players who want a change of scenery. Vladimir Tarasenko is among those. His team would like the same. Here's Saravelli talking about everything that's been going on around the shoulder injury.
Yesterday, more teams had reached out to the St. Louis Blues, even beyond the list of teams that Tarasenko had provided to the Blues previously that he'd be interested in going to. So there's certainly interest there. And with regards to the shoulder, I think it's really interesting the way that it played out. You know, in doing some fact-checking behind the scenes, he had two essentially botched shoulder surgeries conducted, I believe, by the Blues medical staff.
Right.
That basically his shoulder, not to get too graphic, kept popping out and would continually pop out throughout the season. And so then he goes to have this third shoulder surgery, not with the Blues group. I believe it was in Colorado. And they opened him up and they just said, I can't believe they missed this. Like, this is a really simple fix. They made the fix, and now he's 100% and ready to go, not anticipating any issues moving forward beyond that. So that was one of the things when you look at, you know, it's not just the shoulder surgeries and what went wrong. Look, mistakes happen. I think where this relationship really ended up being fractured was the fact that I think throughout the process, as these issues popped up, there was some sort of questioning from the Blues saying, are you committed? You know, why aren't you rehabbing? Why isn't this going well? What's going on here? And so I think that was part of it behind the scenes that really kind of pushed us in a direction where he's not going to be coming back to St. Louis and wanted to have that change of scenery.
What is this, Lethal Weapon? I don't know if you watched that movie back in the day, but that was part of the plot line. Mel Gibson's shoulder would always pop out, and you have to smash it against lockers to pop it back in. Is that what's going on with Vladimir Tarasenko? If so, that's bad surgery. That is not good.
That's not good for a hockey player that relies on his shoulders night in and night out. It's a, you know, it's obvious now, and we thought it before what St. Louis came out and saying, well, even if he hadn't asked for a trade, we were probably going to move him and move on from him. It's a marriage that is coming to an end. The divorce is inevitable. It's just a matter of what are the St. Louis Blues going to get back in return for Vladimir Tarasenko? He's got these issues from everything we heard. We had Kevin Weeks on our show last week. He shares an agent with him, and he said, you know, he seems to be in the best shape of his life. He's working really hard. He's committed, so that's not an issue. I don't know about the health of the actual shoulder. He said it was pretty healthy, but, I mean, it's a sniper that you put him on a Stanley Cup contender team if someone's willing to take on that cap hit and the actual dollar figures. Just remember, it's $9.5 million owed this season to Vladimir Tarasenko versus the actual cap hit. So it'll be interesting to see what St. Louis can get back, because the more these things get out, it's kind of like more St. Louis's hands are tied, don't you think?
Maybe. It really depends the poker game that gets played. I agree that optically it looks that way right now. Hey, they need to get out from under this. But ultimately, is Vladimir Tarasenko going to sit out? Does he need to play hockey? Is there no possibility he suits up for the Blues again? We've seen situations in the past, and I know everybody's different. The one that springs to mind is Jonathan Drouin. Now, he was trying to crack an NHL roster in Tampa Bay. It was a little bit different. It wasn't working out. Didn't like the ice time. But remember at the time, Yzerman's got to trade Drouin. He's got to trade him. And he didn't. And he said, we've talked to the camp, and we believe that there's a future here. And Drouin played there for quite a while longer, and eventually they moved Jonathan Drouin. Eventually he got what he wanted. It just didn't happen right away. I don't know where they're at with Tarasenko. I don't know what the appetite is. That's a flat cap environment now compared to what existed when the Drouin deal went down, younger player, all of those different things. There are a bunch of different factors here. With St. Louis, really this boils down to how much pressure do they feel to retool, get this core back to a place where it was competing for a Stanley Cup and ultimately winning one a couple of years ago, and how much does this cap hit inhibit their ability to do that moving forward?
Yeah, and I mean, you look at the division and all those kind of things that are going, I mean, they won the Central Division a couple of years ago, but can they get back to that? And is this like a Matt Duchene thing as well, Scott? Like, is this one of those things where, you know, Joe Sakic didn't get what he wanted in the offseason, Matt Duchene was changing in a different locker room, apparently were the reports, by the time that he was traded, but in the end, he was able to get the assets that he wanted for a player that wanted out, disgruntled player that wanted out. Frank Saravelli did say in that interview as well, he said, like, there's been a list of teams that Vladimir Tarasenko has submitted to the St. Louis Blues, and because he has a full no trade clause, but St. Louis has been going out and asking other teams that are not on that list because they're trying to see if there is something that maybe they could sell Vladimir Tarasenko on. It's obvious. I mean, they would like to trade it, move on from him. He wants to move on. So it looks like both parties are trying to make a way to figure that out and make it happen.
The NHL offseason market continues to churn. Who knows? Maybe we get more breaking news on that front before the end of the show today. We got something unexpected with the buyouts earlier. We'll continue to factor that in. I didn't get to that Steven Brunt clip. I want to get there next. And you guys had a conversation interrupted yesterday that, because of that, I have a chance to get in on. We'll tell you what that is next on Rintoul and Sermon.